More people died on Montana's roadways this year than last, but fewer of those fatalities involved alcohol. Good evening, I'm Madeline Beck.
And I'm Connor Ballantyne, and Capitol reporter Dan Boyce has our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
We'll also have an update on cleanup of the Upper Clark Fork River, and in our feature tonight, the MTPR news staff looks back at the top stories of the past year, from politics to firestorms. 2013 saw more deaths on Montana's highways. Vehicle-related deaths jumped nearly 10% this year, 224 people killed, compared with 204 in 2012. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce tells us it's the statistics within that higher figure that are puzzling troopers the most.
Regional commander for the eastern part of the state, James Moody, he says Montana typically has about 200 highway deaths a year.
We're always right in there.
Sometimes less. In 2013, it's two dozen more. Of particular note, alcohol-related highway deaths were down.
Way down. 30% down.
Deaths where speed was a factor also dropped. But Moody says pedestrian-related deaths skyrocketed more than 200%, from 7 deaths in 2012 to 23 in 2013.
This pedestrian thing, we're all scratching our heads going out. What the heck? I mean, that's huge. There's something going on, and we don't really know what it is yet.
He predicts cell phone-related distractions could be responsible for some of this increase, but it's difficult to put any hard evidence to that. Deaths involving commercial vehicles are up, which he attributes to increased activity in the Bakken oil field. He also says that could be the reason for more out-of-state vehicle crashes.
We had a huge influx of traffic that's coming through here from Idaho, Utah, Colorado, Washington, Oregon.
Moody says higher death years like this are disheartening.
It sometimes makes you feel like you're spinning your wheels. You know, you start questioning some of our penalties.
He says the Highway Patrol is always looking for ways to bring down the number of vehicle-related deaths. But in his opinion, putting more troopers on the road could do more good than anything.
I know factually, and I know deep down in my heart, that manpower is one of our biggest obstacles.
The Montana legislature did add 5 troopers this year to boost patrols of the Bakken region. Moody does not believe it's enough to address the increasing traffic and population in Montana. I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
And in other news from around the state, a 2010 investigation by the U.S. Army's Inspector General concluded that Lieutenant Governor and senatorial candidate John Walsh used his position as Montana Adjutant General for private gain. The report also says Walsh improperly used government resources and improperly endorsed a non-federal entity. Lee Newspapers of Montana reports the investigation followed complaints by troops who said Walsh coerced them to pay dues to join the National Guard Association of the United States. Walsh was on the board of the private group and was running for a leadership post. Walsh says he disagreed with the conclusion of the investigation. He was not disciplined. Former Governor Brian Schweitzer says he threw away the report and called it, quote, much ado about nothing, end quote. Walsh is running for the Senate seat being vacated by Senator Max Baucus.
The University of Montana's athletic program still leads state schools in generating revenue, but Montana State University is gaining ground. The Bozeman Daily Chronicle reports that annual reports submitted to the Montana Board of Regents show the Bobcats have narrowed the revenue gap with the Grizzlies over the past 5 years. The reports show the University of Montana programs raised $20 million in the fiscal year ending June 2013 compared to Montana State's $18 million. 5 years ago, the Bobcats raised 84 cents for every $1 raised by the Grizzlies. Last year, that rose to 90 cents for every dollar. MSU Athletics Director Peter Field says Montana State is not necessarily looking to keep up with the Grizzlies, but with the entire Big Sky Conference and national trends.
The Montana Department of Environmental Quality has mostly completed the first phase of the Clark Fork River cleanup near Warm Springs. Mining waste contaminated its banks and floodplain over 100 years ago. The cleanup started in March of this year. DEQ Director Tracy Stone Manning says this first year of the 15-year cleanup was a tremendous success.
Rivers provide us so much. They provide us clean water for drinking. They provide us water for agricultural use. They provide us water for recreation. And to be able to bring a river back to fully functioning life is a remarkable a remarkable opportunity. And so 15 years from now, when this is all said and done, and we have a thriving river, finally the landowners who for over 100 years have lived in a valley that had unacceptable mining impacts will live in a different and better place.
More with Tracy Stone Manning tomorrow on Montana Evening Edition.
A Montana-based craft brewer is suing the world's largest beer maker, alleging that popular YouTube videos for Bud Light violate its trademarked phrase, quote, "Hold my beer and watch this," end quote. Big Sky Brewing Company sued Anheuser-Busch this month in U.S. District Court in Missoula. The company says it has used the slogan since at least 2004 and has a trademark. At issue are three videos on Bud Light's official YouTube site created by actor John Krasinski, best known for playing Jim Halpert on NBC's The Office, and his business partner. The videos debuted about a month ago and have nearly 5 million views. Bud Light's marketing vice president Rob McCarthy says there is no trademarked use of the phrase. He said other videos and jokes use the same or similar wording.
A judge says the co-founder of the Yellowstone Club is in contempt of court for selling a resort in Mexico that was part of bankruptcy proceedings. U.S. District Judge Sam Haddon's December 23rd ruling asks Magistrate Judge Keith Strong to recommend sanctions against Tim Blixeth. Yellowstone Club Liquidating Trust trustee Brian Glasser says Blixeth violated a court order when he sold the Tamarindo Ocean Resort. Blixeth's attorney responded that Blixeth believed he was legally capable of selling the resort without violating any court orders. Attorney Patrick Fox wrote the resort was in a hot spot for drug cartel violence, was losing money, and Mexican authorities threatened to seize it over unpaid taxes. Fox says Blixeth sold the resort in 2011 for $13 million, and all the proceeds have been spent.
Coming up next, the Montana Public Radio news staff takes a look back at some of the stories that topped our news in 2013.
Good evening, I'm Sally Mock, and welcome to our look back at some of the top news stories of the past year. I'm joined in the studio by Edward O'Brien.
Hi, Sally.
And from our Helena office, Capitol reporter Dan Boyce.
Hey, Sally.
And on the phone from Big Fork, Flathead reporter Catherine Fry.
Hi, everyone.
Dan, 2013 kicked off with a new governor and a new legislature, and you were there for both.
Sally, watching the transfer of power is a humbling experience. The swearing-in ceremony took place on the north steps of the Capitol building. It was a cold January morning, and a pretty sizable crowd bundled up for it. Montanans swore in a new attorney general in Tim Fox, and then our previous attorney general, Steve Bullock, stepped into the role of governor.
And to discharge the duties of my office.
With fidelity.
With fidelity.
So help me God.
So help me God.
Governor, congratulations.
This was also the same day the 2013 legislature started, and our new governor asked lawmakers to work not necessarily for the good of the party, but for citizens.
They won't measure our success by political points scored or zingers flung out on the front page of the newspaper. I look forward to working with each and every one of you, regardless of the partisan labels attached to our names.
Dan, so how closely did lawmakers follow the governor's suggestions?
Well, I guess that's debatable. On one hand, the legislature did showcase some unprecedented bipartisanship. The House, for instance, passed the state's main budget bill unanimously, 100-0. That certainly had never happened before. Lawmakers also reached across party lines to pass a major reform of state education funding and a fix to Montana's beleaguered public employee pension systems.
But on the other hand, this legislature was also marked by historic partisan wrangling.
Yeah.
House Bill number 104 having been read three several times, the question is, shall the bill pass the Senate? Those in favor will vote yes, those opposed vote no. Has every member voted? Does any member wish to change his or her vote?
So what you're hearing is the sound of Democratic senators pounding on their desks and shouting as Republican Senate President Jeff Essman calls for votes the Democrats felt were in violation of the state constitution.
And that's because Democrats thought they had blocked those votes.
Right. The Democrats used this obscure procedure called a call of the Senate, where one senator went mysteriously missing, and so votes on bills were supposed to be halted until that senator could be found. It was Browning Democrat Shannon Ogier. If the voting could be held up all day looking for Ogier, some bills Democrats really did not like would have missed a deadline and would have died.
But Republicans took the votes anyway.
Yeah, they found their own legal way to justify the votes. And I guess you'd say Republicans won because the Democrats didn't challenge those votes. Really, though, the whole ordeal was embarrassing for both parties.
And also of note from the legislature, Dan, lawmakers failed to approve expanding Medicaid under the new Federal Affordable Care Act, and that would have covered uninsured low-income people.
The U.S. Supreme Court ruled the federal government could not force Medicaid expansion on states as was originally intended, so it's become an optional piece of Obamacare. And even though the federal government is offering to pay for almost all the costs of expansion, at least 21 states have decided not to take it at this point.
And in Montana, it would have covered 70,000 uninsured people.
But Governor Bullock didn't introduce the Medicaid expansion bill until two-thirds of the way through the legislature this year. Republicans like Red Lodge Senator Jason Priest said this was way too late for such a big decision.
This is a billion-dollar decision for Montana. We're going to make it in 15 days? It's irresponsible.
Also, Republicans say getting this money from the federal government isn't free money. All of it comes from us as taxpayers anyway. And who knows if the federal government will change its mind in a couple years and leave that cost burden on the states. Governor Bullock counts not expanding Medicaid as a top failure of the legislature this year.
Let me be clear. We will reform health care in Montana. We'll do it with or without the legislature's help.
And that was right after the legislature adjourned. He has mentioned he's keeping all options on the table, including calling a special legislative session to address the issue.
Although that's very unlikely.
Very. But meanwhile, there is an initiative gathering signatures now that would put Medicaid expansion before voters in 2014. However, there's another one gathering signatures that would prohibit the use of any state resources for the Affordable Care Act. So it's all still up in the air.
Dan, thank you. Ed, there were two big trials this year that made headlines for weeks. The first was the trial of University of Montana Grizzly football quarterback Jordan Johnson, who was accused of raping another UM student.
Yeah, indeed. That original police report accusing Johnson of rape was filed early last year. The case went to trial in February of this year, and it attracted intense, as you can imagine, local, statewide, and even national attention. Prosecutors maintain this was a case of a young woman who was attracted to the star quarterback, who they said eventually betrayed her trust by sexually assaulting her. Now, the defense argued no such thing happened. The sex was consensual, and Johnson would have stopped if the woman had objected at any time. Well, the jury returned its not guilty of sexual intercourse without consent verdict after only about two and a half hours of deliberations. And here's how that moment sounded in that jam-packed, standing-room-only courtroom.
We, the jury, all of our number, find the defendant, Jordan Todd Johnson, not guilty.
It was truly an intense and emotionally charged moment.
And Ed, even as the Johnson trial was underway, the U.S. Departments of Justice and Education were investigating complaints that the University of Montana had mishandled reports of sexual assault on campus.
Yeah, that year-long investigation started after 11 assaults involving UM students were reported over an 18-month period. The feds essentially wanted to know if gender discrimination affected how local law enforcement and university officials responded to reports of assault. And investigators determined several women who wanted to report allegations of sexual assault found it difficult to do so. So UM and the DOJ reached agreements to improve the system, essentially retraining prompt resolutions to complaints, a new complaint tracking system, things like that. Montana U.S. Attorney Michael Cotter praised UM for making, as he put it, bold and difficult decisions.
President Engstrom and his staff are to be commended for the cooperation and collaboration with the Department of Justice in developing a sound plan and program which will ensure that the rights and safety of those in the campus community are protected.
And shortly after that announcement, DOJ announced an agreement with the Missoula Police Department to improve its response to reports of sexual violence. And Mayor John Engen said lots of good would come from that very difficult experience.
And I have confidence that we'll be in compliance well within the 2-year period and that we won't rest on our laurels in the wake of that, that we'll always seek to improve and that we'll always be trying to get better. That's what this community has been about for a very long time, and I suspect it will be for a very long time to come.
But, Ed, not every Missoula official is on board with the Fed's involvement in this process.
Yeah, that's correct. There's one very notable exception, and that's County Attorney Fred Van Valkenburg. He maintains the Feds have no cause or jurisdiction to investigate his office's handling of sex assault cases. Not only that, he dared them to do anything about it, and so far they have not taken him up on his offer, but that could change. Van Valkenburg was a guest speaker at a local public forum back in June, and Sally, it was easily one of the most candid and interesting events I covered this year. Here's a small sample from his City Club appearance.
I think this whole thing happened to a large degree in 2012 because it was a presidential election year, because the people in the Department of Justice Civil Rights Division thought somehow or another they were doing the administration a favor by showing that they somehow or another cared more about women than other people cared.
So Van Valkenburg's stance rankled some Missoulians, generated support from others. He's not running again for county attorney in 2014, and it'll be interesting to see how or even if his defiant stance affects that race.
And then, of course, the other big trial, Ed, which also drew even international attention, was another Jordan Graham, accused of murdering her husband of 8 days by pushing him off a cliff in Glacier National Park.
Yeah, the 22-year-old woman pleaded guilty to shoving her 25-year-old husband, Cody Johnson, to his death as they argued about her second thoughts about their new marriage. That surprise plea agreement with prosecutors came just moments before closing arguments were set to begin in her trial earlier this month. She could face a maximum of life in prison when she's sentenced in late March.
Thanks, Ed. And, Catherine, visitors to Glacier Park this fall, some of whom had traveled long distances, found to their dismay that the park was closed because of the government shutdown.
Sally, arguably one of the most visible effects of the government shutdown was the closure of national parks. On the first morning of the government shutdown, October 1st, I was in West Glacier at the entrance and saw a number of cars with license plates from all over driving up to the gate, turning around, and heading off when they saw the entrance closed up and barricaded. One of those travelers was Louise Bridou, who came all the way from France to hike and camp in Glacier Park.
It's our first time in the U.S. We come from France, so yeah, I think it's going to be the last.
A lot of disappointment from people at the entrance. Glacier National Park is a big draw for tourism in the area all summer long. And during the shutdown, I spoke with Jan Metzmaker of the Whitefish Convention and Visitors Bureau about all the effort they and other agencies have been putting into boosting the shoulder season, particularly Glacier in the fall.
And fall is such a great time to be in the Flathead and with fall colors and, you know, not as many people, and it's more relaxed. And so we really emphasize that kind of secret season when you're here without the tourists.
Many businesses closed their doors early when the park shut down. And Sally, the other big political news, of course, was the surprise announcement by Montana's senior senator, Max Baucus, that he would not run for re-election.
And that was an announcement that took absolutely everyone by surprise, Catherine. As chairman of the powerful Senate Finance Committee, Baucus has tremendous seniority in the Senate, and at 72, he's in excellent health. But he said he was ready to come home to Montana when his term ends in 2014.
I want to spend more time home. I want to come home. And because my roots are so deeply grown in Montana soil.
Only, of course, he's apparently not coming home to Montana at the end of 2014, as the other shocking announcement that came out just this December is that President Obama has nominated Senator Baucus to be the next ambassador to China. So if he's confirmed by the Senate, Baucus will be heading to Beijing instead of Bozeman.
And now, Sally, Governor Steve Bullock gets to name his replacement to fill out Senator Baucus's term. And the great speculation is that he will appoint his lieutenant governor, John Walsh, who is running for the now open seat.
Well, that's right, Dan. And Walsh is considered the Democrat most likely to win the primary. And Republican Steve Daines is considered the front runner in the Republican primary. Former Governor Brian Schweitzer also churned up the political stew when he announced he would not run for this open Senate seat.
We wish the body politic the best of luck in the future.
But I've said for some time that I didn't think I would fit in Washington, D.C. I don't like the kind of clothes they have to wear. I don't like traffic. I don't like the weather. And I really don't like it that it's a town that seems to be run by the corporate interests and the lobbyists. And unfortunately, the people who do get elected, they spend most of their time on the phone trying to raise enough money to get reelected.
But, of course, Schweitzer's seeming aversion to Washington may be waning as he's making noises now that he might run for president in 2016.
And Sally, politics aside for just a moment, what kept all of us busy in the newsroom in August was another intense fire season, with the biggest fire, the Lolo Creek Complex, breaking out just southwest of Missoula along Highway 12.
That's right, Ed. And that lightning-caused fire grew to over 10,000 acres, destroyed five homes, and at one point even had the community of Lolo on pre-evacuation alert. Firefighters managed to save several homes, but this fire once again showed the importance of creating defensible space if you're going to build a home in the woods. And that's something the fire incident commander Greg Ponson strongly urged.
To try and clear some of that flammable material away from their homes so that their property and their homes can survive without putting firefighters in harm's way to protect their property. There's a lot of things they can do ahead of time that makes a huge difference.
And homeowners in the fire's path, I think, got that message. Residents of Sleeman Gulch were evacuated, and some, like Rob McDonough, weren't sure if they would have a place to come home to.
And my wife and I just looked at each other and figured that more than likely we lost our homes.
Luckily, the homes in Sleeman Gulch were spared. Resident Christine Wren summed up how the experience of almost losing their homes to fire really changed them.
I just felt extremely humbled, I think, and appreciative in the way that Mark has talked about that what sticks and is important is people and your relationships with them and your memories of what's in your heart. And so much of that, I think, is for us will be a legacy of the strength of our working together, helping each other out, making good plans ahead of time to try to expedite that in our community here. And I'm just very appreciative that I have a home and people around me who care deeply for each other.
And that Sleeman Gulch resident's gratitude extends not just to her neighbors, but to all the firefighters whose hard work saved so many homes this summer. And I want to thank our new staff, Ed O'Brien, Dan Boyce, and Catherine Fry, for all your hard work this year bringing these stories to our listeners. And, of course, our student anchors, Connor Ballantyne and Madeline Beck. And finally, all our listeners who tune in every day. And we sure hope you'll join us again in the new year for all the new stories that we're going to be reporting. Happy New Year, everyone.
Health and
Happy
prosperity.
Happy New Year, Sally.
Here's to 2014. Thanks, Sally.
Now for tonight's forecast. Most of the divide, there's a winter weather advisory in effect until 11 p.m. this evening for the West Glacier region, the Bitterroot Sapphire Mountains, the Potomac Sealy Lake region, and the lower Clark Fork region. Tonight should be cloudy with areas of rain and snow, as well as areas of freezing fog and lows in the 20s. Tomorrow calls for mostly cloudy skies with a slight chance of snow, areas of freezing fog, and highs in the mid-30s to lower 40s. In central Montana, there's a winter weather advisory in effect until 5 a.m. tomorrow for elevations above 4,000 feet for the Rocky Mountain Front, Cascade County, Central and Southern Lewis and Clark County, Judith Basin, Marr, Hill, Shodo, Toole, Liberty, Blaine, and Fergus counties. Tonight should be mostly cloudy with a chance of snow and lows 5 to 20 degrees. Tomorrow, look for mostly cloudy skies with a slight chance of snow through the day and highs in the 30s. In southwest Montana, there's also a winter weather advisory in effect until 5 a.m. tomorrow for elevations above 5,000 feet for Beaverhead, Madison, Jefferson, Broadwater, and Gallatin counties. Tonight, snow is likely with lows 15 to 25 degrees. Tomorrow, look for increasing clouds, bringing a slight chance of snow through the day and highs in the 30s. And now for the editorial comments of Dan Gallagher.
This is Dan Gallagher with Veterans Viewpoint. Today is the final day of 2013, New Year's Eve. Tomorrow we begin a new year, 12 new pages on the calendar of 2014. In some countries and within some cultures, as the first minutes of a new year grow near, the doors of the dwelling are opened wide to let the new year in. Or is it to let the old year out? Or both? But for many people, the reason for this celebration is inebriation and random acts of foolishness, or bowl games. Now, we often make wishes and resolutions as part of a New Year's ritual, but they always seem to me to be more obligatory gestures than genuine pledges. Yet there is something appealing about making resolutions and something romantic about the opening of the door at midnight custom. And while not giving particular weight to the unique importance of a January 1st resolution, I do make them. For 2014, mine would be to finally finish and have printed the book that I've been working on for what seems forever, to have health and safety for myself and for my family, to continue teaching and working with young people, and to make enough money to stay free of the poorhouse. And who knows, maybe even, as Vin Scully said in the movie For Love of the Game, to push the sun back up in the sky and give us one more day of summer. Pretty lofty goal, huh? And I would resolve to do my best to put together commentaries that are interesting, informative, and of quality. In my role as a veterans advocate, aside from continuing the commentaries and putting together meaningful veteran recognition ceremonies, I resolve to do what I can to assure that all those who became veterans by keeping faith with this country would return to, or will have returned to, a country that keeps faith with them, their service, and their needs. Now, one of the most glaring needs veterans now have is that of having the quickest and highest quality attention given to their claims for the benefits and care promised to them when they first donned the uniform. There's a new effort or program in the VA to process new veteran claims completely within a 125-day period at a 98% level of what's referred to as accuracy, meaning free of specific factual errors. And this is to be fully in place by next year, 2015. I'm skeptical that this is even a remote possibility, not just because of my accumulated cynicism, but because I question the criteria, standards, and figures that the VA now uses against which success in this new effort will be measured. For example, the VA says that current claims are taking approximately 180 days to process, but that's so unreal as to be laughable. While I imagine that some claims are now processed in 180 days, my experience in helping veterans pursue their claims and the experience of most others like myself tell me that 180 days would be lightning speed in claims processing for the VA. 2 years now, a more realistic processing time frame. And just what does completion mean? Is it simply arriving at some preliminary stage where a service connection is or is not found to exist and a minimal rating applied? Or is it the point at which a veteran would recognize a reasonable and satisfactory determination has been reached? And when the VA talks of accuracy in claims processing, are they talking simply of a legalistic black-letter accuracy or the accuracy that's known to the veteran who filed the claim? In a recent Senate hearing, under tough questioning by Senators Bernie Sanders and Richard Burr, political opposites, the VA's claim of a current 90% accuracy was challenged. The senators citing American Legion testimony that their review of 260 claims had shown an accuracy level of only 55%. Are they, the American Legion, wrong? Burr asked the VA's representative. Her response was that it was, quote, an apples and oranges discussion. And then she added, quote, they're right for the way they look at it. We're right for the way we measure it, which is statistically valid. Now, what the hell does that mean? More importantly, that sort of doublespeak coming from the VA demonstrates their continuation of creative denial and verbal strangulation of veterans' claims and needs, and that leaves me depressed about the success of any new effort on their part. And as to speeding up the process, I fear that in the end, that could merely mean quicker claim denials. After all, the easiest and fastest way to hasten claim completion would be to simply re-ink and apply the denial stamp that they already use so freely. You know, my nature allows me to hope, but history tells me not to assume. So I keep my resolutions as basic as possible. That way their accomplishment is more likely. I hope your resolutions and New Year's wishes are fulfilled and fruitful, and I wish each of you a happy 2014. This is Dan Gallagher with Veterans Viewpoint.
Dan Gallagher is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. Views expressed don't necessarily represent those of this station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Madeline Beck.
And I'm Connor Ballantyne. Thanks for listening. Please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News, and have a safe and happy New Year.